Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening. I'm Stesha Brandon, the Literature and Humanities Program Manager. Welcome to Central Library and to tonight's event with Heather Gudenkoff, presented in partnership with the Hearing, Speech, and Deaf Center. We're grateful to University Bookstore for being here tonight. We would also like to thank our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and the Seattle Times for their generous support for library programs. I would also like to thank the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Private gifts to the foundation from thousands of donors help the library to provide free programs and services that touch the lives of everyone in our community. So to Library Foundation donors here with us tonight, we say thank you very much for your support. I'd now like to welcome James House, Communication Specialist at the Hearing, Speech, and Deaf Center, to say a few words about their work.
So we have many brochures here on this front table, and I'm from the Hearing, Speech, and Deafness Center, which is here in Seattle, and we provide a wide array of anything. If you know of any deaf people, hard of hearing people, do you know one out of five Americans has some type of hearing loss? Some of them might be completely deaf, hard of hearing, what have you, but the services we provide are for all of those people that can come to us, and they can get services such as new hearing aids we provide, services for deaf kids. We have education tools as well. If people need speech therapy, we provide that. Interpreting services, you name it. There's a wide array of services that we provide. We work with the state of Washington, and we work to provide advocacy services as well. For example, immigration issues, anybody who might need their driver's license if they're having a problem with the test for some reason, we're able to help them with that. We'll help them pass the test. The list goes on and on. And my work is never the same. Every day it's something different and exciting. So that's what we do here at HSDC, and we really are a great sponsor. So thank you so much for letting us be here and be a part of this tonight. Thank you.
Thanks so much, James and Priya. And now I'm delighted to introduce Heather Gudenkoff. Heather is an Edgar Award-nominated New York Times and USA Today best-selling author. Her work has been described as masterful and intelligent and compared to the likes of Lisa Scottolina and Jodi Picoult. Her newest book, Not a Sound, introduces Amelia Wynn, a former nurse who is swept into an investigation that hits all too close to home. Here to tell us more, please help me welcome Heather Gudenkoff.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be in Seattle today. This is only the second time I've been able to visit your beautiful city. So I had a great time last night. I reconnected with a high school classmate of mine who I haven't seen in 25 years. So we were able to spend some time together last night. And I had some time today to walk around the waterfront, so beautiful. So thank you for coming out on such a beautiful night as well. To talk about how I came to writing, I need to talk about how I came to be a reader. And it all has to do with a footbridge, a library, and a school. So when I was born the youngest of six, on Rosebud Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And my dad was a school counselor there, and my mom was a school nurse. And I grew up hearing stories of the wonderful people that my family worked with, the families that they got to know, their friends. And we moved away from the reservation when I was very young, but these stories came with me. And my family loved it there, but, you know, as things happen, things change, we moved to Iowa. And as a going-away present, my father's students built him and our family a beautiful toy chest made out of wood and sent it along with us to my new hometown, Mason City, Iowa. So you may have never heard of Mason City, Iowa, but you may have heard of the musical The Music Man. Have you heard of that? So The Music Man is fashioned after the town I grew up in. So in the musical, it was River City, Iowa. There's Trouble in River City. You might be familiar with that song. And it was written by Meredith Willson, who is a famous composer. And so we moved to Mason City when I was very young. And many people don't realize that there really is a beautiful library in Mason City, and you have to get there through a walking path, a footbridge. And in the story, if you're familiar, it's the story of a ne'er-to-do salesman who tries to sell the town non-existent musical instruments. And there's this footbridge, this library, and there is a librarian named Marion. Okay, so there's a footbridge, there's a library, and even in high school, I did have a librarian whose name was Sister Marion, but it wasn't at the public library. So growing up, I would watch my brothers and sisters, I have five of them, go off to school before me, and I couldn't wait to join them. I wanted to have that book bag, I wanted to have the school supplies, I wanted to know what they were looking at when they opened up their books and when they would write it on pieces of paper, and it was such a mystery to me, and I was so jealous. I would stand by the door and wait for them to come home, and here we'd play school, we had this in our garage, we had a big shelf where we would climb up and we would play a school there, and I just couldn't wait to get there one day. Well, I finally got there. And it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It wasn't all that it was cracked up to be. I got to school, and it was really hard. It was really, really challenging for me. I was one of those kids who was always 20 steps behind the rest. I was the one who was always nudging her neighbor, saying, "What did the teacher say? What are we supposed to be doing?" And I was the one who was always still sitting in her seat while everybody else was lined up for gym and music class. And so I would come home from school absolutely exhausted, just so tired. And I didn't know why. I just knew that school was really hard and I was not as good a student as my classmates. So once a month from my school, our teacher would hand out our library cards. And we would walk across a footbridge to the public library where this wonderful librarian was there, ready to read a story to us in the children's section and then release us into the stacks to find books that are just right for us. And I love that time of day. I just loved it. Or that time of when we were able to travel to the library. And we were allowed to check out a few books, but it was only a few books, and I never understood why I couldn't just have an armful and carry that back to the school. And but we could check out three or four, and I had to live with that, and that was okay. But I would come home from school with my stack of books. I would come home to a very busy household, five older brothers and sisters, my wonderful parents, and we always had animals. We always had a dog. There was a cat or two. Sometimes we would have gerbils and hamsters. For some reason, we always had hermit crabs, and I don't know if it was the same hermit crab that we had for like 7 years, but we always seemed to have a hermit crab or it was being replaced. And we once even had a tarantula. Now, to my mom's credit, she didn't know we had it until when she did find out, it got sent to the garage for a while anyway. And so I came home and just wanted to escape. I was tired. I shared a room with my two older sisters. and I just wanted my own space. So I would go to the toy box. I would pull out all the toys, throw them aside. I would grab my stack of books from the library. I would grab a pillow and a flashlight, climb inside, and close the lid and look at the pictures. So that was really where my love of reading began and my love of books. But in the meantime, school was still pretty hard for me, still really difficult. And I was, just had a hard time with it and didn't enjoy it like I'd really hoped. I knew from the time I was a kindergartner that I wanted to be a teacher. And this experience I was having in school was really getting in the way of that, because I thought, if I'm not enjoying it now, how am I going to enjoy it as an adult? But one day, a big RV-type vehicle pulled up in front of our school, and our teacher said, "You're going to take a test." And I thought, oh, great, another test for me to do poorly on. So one by one, each of the students would climb onto this RV, and we were met there by a very nice gentleman who said he was an audiologist, and he sat me down and said, "All you have to do is raise your hand when you hear the beeps." And I thought, I can do this. This is a test that I will do fabulous at. I can raise my hand. I will be all right with this. So he put the earphones on, and every time I heard a beep, I raised my hand. Raised my hand, raised my right hand, raised my right hand. And when I was done, I felt really good. And I got off the RV, the little bus, and trotted back to my classroom and went home. Well, soon after, my parents got a phone call, and it was from the school, and letting them know that I did have a profound unilateral hearing loss, which simply means I can't hear out of my left ear. But things started to make a lot of sense then. That's why I sat so close to the television set. That's why I didn't know what was going on this side of me all the time, where people could call my name and I would have no idea. And my brothers and sisters had a lot of fun with that. And that is why school was really hard, because with my type of hearing loss, noisy situations are very challenging. Noisy classrooms, noisy restaurants. And so I was quickly fitted for a set of hearing aids, which really did help, but I had a love-hate relationship with my hearing aids. I was an active kid, and I would, at recess and in gym, they'd fly off my head while I was running, and I'd have to stop and pick them up and put them on again. And so there were many times when I came home on the bus that I would accidentally, on purpose, leave them on the seat next to me. And my dad would have to drive us back to the bus barn, and we'd walk through the bus up and down the aisle, and darned if we didn't always find those hearing aids. But they did help. And I quickly began to catch up with my classmates and did quite well. But still with that was my love of reading. Eventually, I traveled to the University of Iowa, and I went to school for what I had always wanted to do, which was to be a teacher, and got my first job. And interestingly, it was back in Mason City, back in the same school, back in the same classroom where I had traveled to the library once a month with my fourth grade class. So with my own fourth grade students, once a month I would hand out the library cards. We would walk across the footbridge to the public library, where this wonderful librarian was there waiting for us, and she would read a book to my students in the children's library, and then release them into the stacks so that they could find books that were just right for them. And very quickly, I realized why we were only allowed to check out 3 books from the library on those trips. So 25 fourth graders over open water walking across a bridge is, kind of frightening for a classroom teacher. So it made a lot of sense, and I did impose that rule myself. But I never lost a book over the side of the railing anyway. So really went full circle with the library and my love of libraries. Soon after my first teaching job in Mason City, I got married, and I moved to a beautiful city on the Mississippi River, Dubuque, Iowa. It's where where Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois meet. And as a wedding present, my parents painted that toy box, this beautiful cream-colored. They stenciled roses across it and filled it with linens and towels and all the things that we would need to start our married life together, and sent that with us. And I began a teaching career in Dubuque. I taught just about every grade level, third grade, fourth grade, special needs. I even taught sixth and seventh grade for a time, and really just started to live my life as an educator. And there was something that I did as a teacher that a lot of teachers do. This is nothing new, nothing unique to what I got the idea from another teacher. But every day we would end our class day with the students with a little chant. So I would start with "have a good," and then everybody would say "night." And I would say, "watch out for cars." And there's a reason I said that, because as someone with a hearing loss, I could never tell where sounds came from. And I did get hit by a car once in junior high. Perfectly okay. But that was something that I always said with my students. So watch out for cars. Do your homework. Read a book. Dream big. And in our best Winston Churchill accent, never, ever give up. And I can't wait to see you again. And we would say this every day, no matter what. It wouldn't matter if the bus drivers were honking their horns. It wouldn't matter if, you know, we're still putting on snow pants and hats and gloves. We'd say it fast walking down the hallway to leave, but we had to say those words. And after doing that for year after year, time after time, I realized that those words weren't just for my students. Dream big, never give up. They were for me as well. And as I mentioned, I definitely was a reader first, but I also always enjoyed writing. And I thought I had a story in me to tell, and I thought about it for a long time. But the day that school got out for summer break, the last time that year, we said, "have a good night, watch out for cars, take care of each other, dream big," I knew I needed to act on it. So I went to the store and bought a beautiful journal and started writing my first novel, The Weight of Silence, in longhand. And by the time I went back and got my classroom ready that fall, I had the first draft completed. And I stuck it in a drawer because I didn't know what to do with it. I was a classroom teacher. I didn't know anybody in the publishing world. So I went back to school teaching my third graders, and I finally, at winter break, pulled it out, the manuscript that I'd finally had put into word processing form, and looked at it and asked myself, what are you going to do? Is it going to stay in the drawer, or are you going to do something with it? I decided I needed to try and do something. So what did I do? I went to my library and got a book called The Writer's Market, which is it's a book that lists all the different publishers and literary agents in North America. And I looked through, and I landed on one agency. I thought, I'm just going to start with one. I'm not going to go crazy here. I'm just going to start with one and just see what happens. And the agency that I chose to send a query letter to was one that represented the kinds of books that I wanted to write, mysteries and thrillers. And it also represented an author that I loved, and her name is Mary Pope Osborne. And so some of you might know that she is the author of the Magic Treehouse series, which is definitely not a mystery. Well, they're mysteries, but not adult mysteries or thrillers. They're books written for third graders and younger children, but as a teacher, I loved her. So I thought, I'm going to try this agency. So I wrote a letter, sent off my first 50 pages, And a few weeks later, I was fortunate enough to get a letter in my mailbox asking to read the rest of the novel. Well, of course, I was over the moon, thrilled, and so I printed off the rest of the manuscript and mailed it off to New York, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited, and months passed, and I didn't hear anything. So finally, I got up the nerve, and I called the agency, and I said, "This is Heather from Iowa," like I'm the absolute only Heather in the state of Iowa. It took her a few moments to figure out who I was, but she asked a few questions and figured it out. And she said, "Yes, I think we can work together, but your manuscript needs a lot of work." And she was right, of course. So she and I spent the next year and a half working on the manuscript, The Weight of Silence, and getting it in better shape. And so how that would work at the time, so this was back in, 2006. I would print off the manuscript, send it to Marianne. She would write all over it with all her red marks and suggestions, and she wrote on it a lot, and she would mail it back to me. And then I would make my changes, print off the manuscript, mail it back to her, and this went back and forth for a year and a half until I had a stack of papers about this high in my basement, which my husband loved, by the way. But a year and a half years worth of work. And finally the day came, and she said, "I think we're ready to send it on to publishers." And of course, again, I was thrilled. And so she, how that works is that my agent would send the manuscript off to a few publishing companies and then wait to hear a response. And I thought, okay, this is good. And then the rejection letters started coming in, one after the other. And so Marianne would send me copies of the rejection letters, and she would always write these very lovely notes on them. She would say, "They're loss," or "They say they like your writing," or "They really like the story." And those came one after the other and after the other. So I, of course, was very disappointed. And I did what many, many people do when they're faced with disappointment. I went into our pantry, which had a pocket door that slid shut. I pulled the phone in with me back when phones had cords, and I called my mom, and I cried. And I said, "They don't like my writing." And, of course, as moms tend to do, she had wise words. She said, "You want whoever picks up your book, if they do, to love it as much as you do." And, of course, she was right. So after a year and a half, Mira Books decided that they wanted to publish The Weight of Silence. So, of course, again, over the moon, very exciting. And the publishing process was in place. And I went on with my education life and started to think of ideas for a next novel. And by this time, I have had three children, three grade school age children. And so they were very excited for me as well, as was my husband. But as life tends to do during the good times, and it comes to kind of hit us in the face once in a while, reality. And so at the time, my oldest, my son, was 13, and he is a tall kid, so he probably was just about 6 foot in seventh grade, and he grew really fast that fall. And he was an active kid who played basketball and football and wrestled. And he started complaining of leg pain. And like the good mom I was, I said, "Take an aspirin." I said, "Put some ice on it. You're fine. It's growing pains." And he continued to say it hurts. So I did make an appointment with our family doctor. And our family doctor just kind of looked at it and said, "Well, I don't know what could be wrong, but I'm going to send you to the orthopedic doctor just to take a closer look." And so we made an appointment for a couple weeks later, and somehow my mom's spidey senses kicked into gear finally, And I decided I didn't want to wait a couple weeks. And so I called and was fortunate enough to get an appointment within a few days. So we went and we saw the orthopedic. They took x-rays. He messed around with his leg a little bit. And while we were waiting for the x-rays to come back, Alex and I were just chatting about school. It was conference time. It was spring. And talking about, you know, what the next sport he was going to play that summer. When the doctor came back in, and he walked in and said, this is not good. This is not good at all. And he put the x-ray up on the screen. And even from my non-medical eye, I could see that there was a big problem. Tumor, which I remember it as being this big, where in more reality it was about this big on his leg. And I pulled the doctor out into the hallway, and I said, is this cancer? And he said, well, we can't know without a biopsy, but yes, it's cancer. So within a few days, we were at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. My son had a biopsy, a port put in, and started chemotherapy even before the biopsy came back. And he was diagnosed with osteosarcoma, which is bone cancer. And so once again, you know, life, how it tends to wake us up once in a while, and we learn what's really important. So yes, I did have a book coming out, but of course it didn't matter. And we spent the next 9 months in Iowa City, 2 weeks there, 1 week home, a week there, a week home, 2 weeks there, for his treatment. And during that time, I started my second novel, These Things Hidden, which really was, in a way, a blessing, because what 13-year-old child wants his mom sitting next to him, staring at him the entire time, you know, he's getting treatment. So I would go off into a little corner and do my writing, and he would watch his computer or play games and such, and do his part in trying to heal and get better. So when the book came out in June, my son was getting chemotherapy. We had just decided that our course of action would be an amputation, above-the-knee amputation. It was just the best choice for him, and he ultimately made that decision. We gave him the options, and we're crossing our fingers that that's what he would choose, and he did. And I got the call that The Way to Silence had landed on the New York Times bestseller list, and of course it was thrilling and it was bittersweet, but my son was getting chemotherapy, so I said, thank you, this is very exciting, but I have to go. Thrilled to say, though, after 9 months of treatment, Alex did great. He was considered cancer-free a few years ago, so now he is 8 years cancer-free. He is going to be a senior at the University of Iowa, and nothing can hold him back. He has skied. He skied. He wrestled in high school. He does jiu-jitsu now, which I think is amazing and kind of scary to me, but he does really well with that. And his two younger sisters, who, you know, sometimes siblings of cancer get kind of left behind a little bit, and they, of course, were such great troopers, but they're doing great as well. And next year, this past Saturday, my youngest graduated from high school, so I'll be an empty nester coming this fall, and I'll have three children at the University of Iowa, which I'm thrilled that they're all going to be in one place. Funny that, you know, people say to us we should get, like, an apartment for them or a house, a fixer-upper, so it'd be cheaper than living in the dorms. But I said they've worked 18 years to get away from each other. I don't think they want to live in the same place. But Alex is doing great, and now I am six novels in. Just finished my seventh novel, and it's been wonderful. Back though to that toy box. So now when I get together with my siblings, I my five older brothers and sisters. We all live in the Midwest, and several of us in Iowa. We'll get together and we'll talk about, do you remember the time when Molly, my sister, released her parakeet out into the wilderness to set it free just 2 minutes before a hailstorm? Or somebody will say, do you remember when Patrick got in the fender bender when Mom and Dad were in Minneapolis at the Neil Diamond concert? And somebody will say, do you remember the time when Greg brought home the tarantula? And I would say, no, I don't remember that. I don't remember that at all. And my brother Greg, of course, would say, that's because you were always in the toy box. So I'm thrilled to say I'm out of the toy box, but I do still have that toy box. Of course, my children played with it, stored their toys in there. But now I keep it in the area where I do my writing, and I put those stacks of manuscripts that I print out are stored in there while I'm working on a project, along with my other writing supplies. But I'm thrilled to be here today with you, so excited to share Not a Sound with you. As was mentioned, it's about a story about Amelia Nguyen, who was a nurse who was deafened due to a hit-and-run accident. And we meet Amelia a few years later. She had lost her hearing. She had lost her career, her family, and was just pulling herself out of this abyss, mostly self-inflicted. And we meet her when she's paddleboarding along a river, much like the Mississippi River where I live, with her service dog, Stitch. And they come across a frightening discovery as they're traveling down the river, and very quickly are pulled into a mystery that could cost both of them their lives. And so for many reasons, this novel has been a very personal one to me, and I won't go into big details because I don't want to give any spoilers away, but it really is one of my favorite books. I love the characters of Amelia and Stitch. I think they're quite the team, and I'm hoping that one day I can write some more about their adventures together. I would love to answer any questions that you may have, and anything about writing, reading, whatever you want to ask about. Yes, the question is, am I still teaching? I am still involved heavily with education. I'm not in the classroom anymore. I am our Title I reading coordinator for our school district, so I work with reading programs for children in high poverty areas in our city. So I work 88% of the time is what my schedule is, so 4 days a week. Yes. Oh, my goodness. So the question is, what is the best sentence-structured sentence I've ever written? I have no idea. I could not answer that question. Hopefully there's one in there. Yes. So the question is, I wrote a book a few years ago that came out right about the same time as a school shooting, and the name of the book was One Breath Away, and it's a story about a school intruder, and it came out just a few weeks before Newtown, and which was just horrible, and immediately I called my publisher and said, you know, do what you have to do. You can pull it from the shelves, whatever needs to happen. And they didn't do that, but of course it was a very difficult time. So the story is about a very small town, and they don't have too many of these schools anymore, but there are a few left in Iowa where it's a K-12 building. So it's, and I don't know if they have those around here too once in a while, usually in rural or smaller communities. And so it's the story of an intruder in a school. And I really got the idea from, I was at the University of Iowa at a time when one of the first well-publicized or well-covered school shootings took place. Gang Liu was the name of the young man who opened fire with a gun in classrooms at the University of Iowa. And while I was well away from the danger, I was on campus that day and saw the police presence, the ambulances, and that really had a huge impact on me, especially as someone who was going to go into the classroom as a teacher. And when I started teaching, I started at a very small private parochial school where I would work till midnight with my windows open, the door propped open. You know, there was no school, there wasn't such thing as school security back then. And then after Columbine, of course, that all changed. So I've seen the change over the years of very tight, no security to very, very tight security where parents have to have background checks to get into some of our schools. And so I wanted to write about that in Not a Sound, but unfortunately, sometimes these terrible things do happen in real life. And what other questions? Yes. Thank you. So the comment was to thank me for representing a deaf character somewhat accurately in the situation. I hope I'm capturing it that way. And I had a lot of help, obviously. And my number one goal was to be as respectful to those with hearing loss as I possibly could, because I can hear. I struggle, you know, admittedly, in noisy situations, but I can hear. So I did call on a lot of people to help me. I, you know, visited with a deaf and hard of hearing teacher in our community, speech pathologists. My brother is a doctor of audiology, largely because of my hearing loss. He went into that field. And I had early readers who are profoundly deaf who were able to give me some really good information. And hopefully I captured that and am accurate and respectful while telling a hopefully compelling story. So thank you for that, those kind words. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. So I tend to write, most of my books are written from multiple perspectives. So it's the story's told from multiple points of view. And I always compare it to a relay race where the characters are passing the baton to the next character to tell the story. And I really enjoy writing that way. Not a Sound is told from one perspective. It's one of the few books that I've done that way. I toyed around with telling it from the point of view of Jake, the police officer, and from the other characters in it. But it really is, for this particular book, it's Amelia's story. And I really wanted to have her voice represent the story. But thank you. Yes. Okay. So the question is, after 6 and 7 books, what has been the biggest shift for me and what have I learned? I think I have learned that it's possible to do several things that you love at once. It is a balancing act. I'm first and foremost a mom, and so that always takes precedence. I love my education life. I come from a family of educators. My dad was a teacher. My great aunt was a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse at one point. And I have a brother who's a teacher and some nieces that are teachers. And I love that life. I love the education life and I love my writing life, but it's a balancing act. So knowing how to balance those, it's been a challenge and I don't always do it well. Sometimes I do it horribly. But keeping in mind that to do the things that you love is very important, and that's important to me. So the question is, what authors do I read today? I read just anything I can get my hands on. I love Anita Shreve. Ann Patchett is a favorite of mine. I love Barbara Kingsolver. Mystery-wise, I'm a big fan of Tess Gerritsen. Louise Penny is a Canadian author who writes a mystery series that I love. It's called the Inspector Gamache Mysteries, and it's set in Canada and in a town called Three Pines. And this is how I describe this series. I think there's 10 books, about 10. So I say, after I read the first book, I thought, these are interesting characters. The second book, I wanted to go and visit Three Pines. By the third book, I wanted to move there. By the fourth book, I wanted to buy into the bookstore that one of the characters owned. And so I'm pretty sure I'm going to retire there, but I don't think it's a real place. But it's a great series by Louise Penny. I'm also a big fan of nonfiction. I read a lot of nonfiction historical works. Candace Millard is one of my favorites, and a book that she wrote called River of Doubt is the true story of how Teddy Roosevelt, traveled down the Amazon River after he was president with his son, and it was the most harrowing book I think I've ever read. I mean, and it's true. I never learned that in high school history class, but so lots of books I really, really love to read, lots of authors. What did I read as a child? Oh, yes, I read the Little House on the Prairie books over and over and over again. I loved Nancy Drew, and I was a big fan of the Ramona books, Ramona Quimby, by Beverly Cleary. Those were favorites of mine. As I got a little bit older, I jumped from Beezus and Ramona to Stephen King, much to my parents. You know, they didn't like that very much, but I always had loved to read. And one time, my mom caught me reading The Thornbirds, and I was in junior high, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, it's the second time I've read it, Mom." So I, had a wide range of likes as a young reader, too. I would love to. So if you have any questions about writing or books that you'd like to ask me personally, I'd be happy to. Or if you'd like me to sign a book, I'd be glad to as well. But thank you so much for coming out on this beautiful night. I know many of you probably want to be out there because it is so lovely. But thank you for coming. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.